As it emerged, Wilder saw that it was the barrel of a shotgun. Surprised, Wilder took the weapon from her hands. She was smiling encouragingly, as if expecting Wilder to go out into the corridor at that very moment and shoot someone dead. He broke the breech. 2 live shells were in place under the hammers. Wilder moved the weapon out of Mrs. Hillman's reach. He realized that this was probably only one of hundreds of similar firearms in the high-rise. Sporting rifles, military service souvenirs, handbag pistols. But no one had fired a single shot, despite the epidemic of violence. Wilder knew perfectly well why. He himself would never bring himself to fire the shotgun, even at the point of death. There was an unspoken agreement among the residents of the high-rise that their confrontation would be resolved by physical means alone. He jammed the shotgun back into the barricade and pushed Mrs. Hillman in the chest.
"Go away, rescue yourself."
As she protested, half playfully, half in earnest, he began to throw dog biscuits at her, scattering them around the bare floor. Wilder enjoyed abusing her. Deriding her in front of her supine husband, he withheld the food from her until she broke down and retreated to the kitchen. The evening progressed happily. Wilder became more and more oafish as the darkness settled over the high-rise, deliberately coarsening himself like a delinquent youth fooling about with a besotted headmistress. Until 2 o'clock that morning, during a night intermittently disrupted by outbreaks of violence, Wilder remained within the Hillman's apartment on the 17th floor. The marked decline in the number of incidents disturbed Wilder. For his ascent of the building, he relied on being able to offer himself as an aggressive street fighter to one or another of the warring groups. However, the open tribal conflicts of the previous week had now clearly ceased. With the breakdown of the clan structure, the formal boundary and armistice lines had dissolved, giving way to a series of small enclaves, a cluster of 3 or 4 isolated apartments. These were far more difficult to penetrate and exploit. Sitting in the darkness on the floor of the sitting room with Mrs. Hillman, their backs to opposite walls, they listened to the muted noises around them. The residents of the high-rise were like creatures in a darkened zoo, lying together in surly quiet, now and then tearing at each other in brief acts of ferocious violence. The Hillman's immediate neighbors, an insurance broker and his wife, 2 account executives and a pharmacologist, were listless and unorganized. Wilder had visited them several times, but found that appeals to self-advantage no longer roused them. In fact, only the most blatant expressions of irrational hostility could galvanize their glazed minds. Wilder's feigned and unfeigned rages, his fantasies of revenge, roused them briefly from their state of torpor. This regrouping around more radical and aggressive leaders was taking place all over the high-rise. In the hours after midnight, torches flared behind the barricades in the lobbies and corridors, where enclaves of 5 or 6 residents squatted among the plastic garbage sacks, inciting each other like wedding guests making themselves drunk in the knowledge that they too will soon be copulating freely among the sweetmeats. At 2 o'clock, Wilder left the Hillman's apartment and set about stirring up his neighbors. The men crouched together, clubs and spears in hand, hip flasks of whiskey pooled at their feet. The torch beams illuminated the garbage sacks piled high around them, a visible museum of their leavings. Wilder sat in the center of the group, outlining his plans for another foraging expedition to the floors above. Although they had eaten little for days, his neighbors were reluctant to take part, fearful of the power of the residents above them. Skillfully, Wilder played on their fantasies. Once again, as his imaginary scapegoat, he selected the psychiatrist Adrian Talbot, whom he now accused of molesting a child in a swimming pool changing cubicle. The untruth of the accusation, which they all well knew, only served to reinforce it. However, before they would move, they insisted that Wilder invent an even more lurid crime, as if the imaginary nature of Talbot's sexual offences held the essence of their appeal. By the logic of the high-rise, those most innocent of any offence became the most guilty. Shortly before dawn, Wilder found himself in an empty apartment on the 26th floor. Once occupied by a woman and her small son, the apartment had recently been abandoned, and no attempt had been made to padlock the door from the outside. Tired after the night's rampage, Wilder wasted no time in breaking down the door. He had sidestepped his raiding party, leaving them to break up Talbot's apartment for the 10th time. During these last minutes of darkness, he would settle himself into an empty apartment and sleep through the long hours of daylight in time to resume his ascent of the high-rise at dusk. Wilder moved around the three rooms, satisfying himself that no one was hiding in the kitchen or bathroom. He wandered about in the darkness, kicking open the cupboards and knocking any books or ornaments to the floor. Before leaving, the owner had made a half-hearted attempt to tidy the apartment, packing away the child's toys in a bedroom wardrobe. The sight of the freshly swept floors and neatly furled curtains unsettled Wilder. He pulled the drawers onto the floor, heaved the mattresses off the beds, and urinated into the bath. His burly figure, trousers open to expose his heavy genitalia, glared at him from the mirrors in the bedroom. He was about to break the glass, but the sight of his penis calmed him, a white club hanging in the darkness. He would have liked to dress it in some way, perhaps with a hair ribbon tied in a floral bow. Now that he was alone, Wilder felt confident of his progress. His hunger was overlaid by his feelings of triumph at having climbed more than halfway up the high-rise. From the windows, the ground below was barely visible, part of a world he had left behind. Somewhere above him, Anthony Royal was strutting about with his white Alsatian, unaware that he would soon be in for a surprise. At dawn, the owner of the apartment reappeared and blundered into the kitchen where Wilder was resting. By now, he had relaxed and was sitting comfortably on the floor with his back against the cooker, the remains of a meal scattered around him. He had found a few cans of food, along with two bottles of red wine, in their invariable hiding place, under the floorboards in the bedroom wardrobe. As he broke open the cans, he played with a battery-powered tape recorder, which had been mixed up with a child's toys. He recorded his grunts and belches, playing them back to himself. Wilder was amused by the deft way in which he edited the tape, overlaying one set of belches with a second and third, a skill that now resided entirely in his scarred fingers, with their cracked and blackened nails. The bottles of claret had made him pleasantly drowsy. Smearing the red wine across his broad chest, he gazed up amiably at the startled woman, who stumbled into the kitchen and tripped across his legs. As she stared down at him, one hand nervously to her throat, Wilder remembered that she had once been called Charlotte Melville. The name had now detached itself from her, like an athlete's tie-on numeral blown away in a gust of wind. He knew that he had often been in this apartment, and this explained the vague familiarity of the child's toys and the furniture, although the chairs and sofa had been rearranged to conceal various hiding places. Wilder? As if uncertain about the name, Charlotte Melville pronounced it softly. She had been sheltering during the night with her son in the apartment of the statistician three floors above, with whom she had become friendly. At the first light, when everything had settled down, she had come back intending to collect the last of her food reserves before abandoning the apartment for good. Swiftly composing herself, she looked down critically at the burly man with the exposed loins, lying like a savage among her wine bottles, his chest painted with red stripes. She felt no sense of loss or outrage, but a fatalistic acceptance of the damage he had casually inflicted on her apartment, like the strong odor of his urine in the bathroom. He appeared to be half asleep, and she stepped slowly towards the door. Wilder reached out with one hand and held her ankle. He smiled up at her blearily. Climbing to his feet, he circled around her, the tape recorder raised in one hand as if about to hit her with it. Instead, he switched it on and off, playing for her his selection of belches and grunts, obviously pleased with this demonstration of his unexpected expertise. He steered her slowly around the apartment as she backed from one room to the next, listening to his edited mutterings. The first time he struck her, cuffing her to the bedroom floor, he tried to record her gasp, but the reel had jammed. He freed it carefully, bent down and slapped her again, only stopping when he had recorded her now deliberate cries to his satisfaction. He enjoyed terrorizing her, taping down her exaggerated but nonetheless frightened gasps. During their clumsy sexual act on the mattress in the child's bedroom, he left the tape recorder switched on beside them on the floor and played back the sound of this brief rape, editing together the noise of her tearing clothes and panting anger. Later, bored with the woman in these games with the tape recorder, he hurled the machine into the corner. The sound of himself speaking, however coarsely, introduced a discordant element. He resented speaking to Charlotte or to anyone else, as if words introduced the wrong set of meanings into everything. After she dressed, they had breakfast together on the balcony, sitting at the table with an incongruous old-world formality. Charlotte ate the scraps of canned meat she found on the kitchen floor. Wilder finished the last of the claret, remarking the red stripes across his chest. The rising sunlight warmed his exposed loins, and he felt like a contented husband, sitting with his wife in a villa high on a mountainside. Naively, he wanted to explain to Charlotte his ascent of the apartment building, and shyly pointed to the roof. But she failed to get the point. She fastened her torn clothes around her strong body. Although her mouth and throat were bruised, she seemed unconcerned, watching Wilder with a passive expression. From the balcony, Wilder could see the roof of the high-rise, little more than a dozen floors above him. The intoxication of living at this height was as palpable as anything produced by the wine bottle in his hand. Already he could see the line of huge birds perched on the balustrades, no doubt waiting for him to arrive and take command. Below, on the 20th floor, a man was cooking over a fire on his balcony, breaking up a coffee table and feeding the legs to the clutch of smoldering sticks on which a soup can was balanced. A police car approached the perimeter entrance. A few residents were leaving for work at this early hour, neatly dressed in suits and raincoats, briefcases in hand. The abandoned cars in the access roads prevented the police from reaching the main entrance of the building, and the officers stepped out and spoke to the passing residents. Usually none of them would have replied to an outsider, but now they gathered in a group around the two policemen. Wilder wondered if they were going to give the game away, but although he could not hear them, he was certain that he knew what they were saying. Clearly they were pacifying the policemen, reassuring them that everything was in order, despite the garbage and broken bottles scattered around the building. Deciding to test the defenses of the apartment before he went to sleep, Wilder stepped into the corridor. He stood outside the doorway as the stale air moved past him to the open balcony. He relished the rich smells of the high-rise. Like their garbage, the excrement of the residents higher up the building had a markedly different odor. Returning to the balcony, he watched the police drive away in their car. Of the 20 or so residents who still left to work each morning, 3 had turned back, evidently unsettled by the task of convincing the police that all was well. Without looking up, they scurried back to the entrance lobby. Wilder knew that they would never leave again. The separation of the high-rise from the world around it was now almost complete, and would probably coincide with his own arrival at the summit. Soothed by this image, he sat down on the floor and leaned against Charlotte Melville's shoulder, falling asleep as she stroked the wine-colored stripes on his chest and shoulders. Chapter 14. Final Triumph. At dusk, after he had strengthened the guard, Anthony Royal ordered the candles lit on the dining room table. Hands in the pockets of his dinner jacket, He stood at the windows of the penthouse apartment on the 40th floor and looked down across the concrete plazas of the development project. All the tenants who had earlier left for their offices had now parked their cars and entered the building. With their safe arrival, Royal felt for the first time that he could relax, like a captain eager to set sail, seeing the last of his crew return from shore leave in a foreign port. The evening had begun. Royal sat down in the high-backed oak chair at the head of the dining table. The candlelight flickered over the silver cutlery and gold plate, reflected in the silk facings of his dinner jacket. As usual, he smiled at the theatricality of this contrived setting, like a badly rehearsed and under-financed television commercial for a high-life product. It had started 3 weeks earlier, when he and Pangborn had decided to dress for dinner each evening. Royal had ordered the women to extend the dining room table to its furthest length, so that he could sit with his back to the high windows and the illuminated decks of the nearby buildings. Responding to Royal, the women had brought candles and silverware from secret caches and served an elaborately prepared meal. Their shadows swayed across the ceiling as if they were moving around the dining chamber of a feudal chief. Sitting in his chair at the far end of the long table, Pangborn had been suitably impressed. Of course, as the gynecologist well knew, the charade was meaningless. A single step beyond the circle of candlelight, the garbage sacks were piled 6 deep against the walls. Outside, the corridors and staircases were filled with broken furniture and barricades built from washing machines and freezer cabinets. The elevator shafts were the new garbage chutes. Not one of the 20 elevators in the apartment building now functioned, and the shafts were piled deep with kitchen refuse and dead dogs. A fading semblance of civilized order still survived in the top 3 floors, the last tribal unit in the high-rise. However, the one error that Royal and Pangborn had made was to assume that there would always be some kind of social organization below them which they could exploit and master. They were now moving into a realm of no social organization at all. The clans had broken down into small groups of killers, solitary hunters who built man-traps in empty apartments, or preyed on the unwary in deserted elevator lobbies. Royal looked up from the polished table as one of the women walked into the room, a silver tray in her strong arms. Watching her, he remembered that she was Mrs. Wilder. She wore one of Anne's well-cut trouser suits, and not for the first time, Royal thought how easily this intelligent woman had fitted into the upper levels of the high-rise. 2 weeks earlier, when she was found cowering with her sons in an empty apartment on the 19th floor after Wilder had abandoned her, she was totally exhausted, numbed by hunger and indignation. Whether in quest of her husband or responding to some dim instinct, she had begun to climb the building. The raiding party brought her to the top floor. Pangborn had wanted to throw out this anemic and rambling woman, but Royal overruled him. Somewhere below, Wilder was still making his ascent of the high-rise, and his wife might one day be a valuable hostage. Led away, she joined the group of outcast wives who lived with their children in the next apartment, earning their keep by working as house servants. Within days, Mrs. Wilder had regained her strength and self-confidence. No longer stunned and stoop-shouldered, she reminded Royal of the serious and attractive wife of an up-and-coming television journalist who had arrived at the high-rise a year earlier. He noticed that she was clearing away Pangborn's place setting, returning the immaculate silverware to her tray. "They seem clean enough," Royal told her. "I don't think Dr. Pangborn will notice." When she ignored him and continued to remove the cutlery, Royal asked, "Have you heard from him? I take it he won't be joining me this evening." "Or any evening. He's decided to decline in future." Mrs. Wilder glanced across the table at Royal, almost as if she had felt a flicker of concern for him. She added matter-of-factly, I should be wary of Dr. Pangborn. I always have been. When a man like Dr. Pangborn loses his appetite for food, it's reasonable to assume that he has something much more interesting between his teeth, and much more dangerous. Royal listened to her cool advice without comment. He was not surprised that the dinners had come to an end. Both he and Pangborn, anticipating the inevitable breakup of the last clan within the apartment building, had now retired to their quarters at opposite ends of the roof, each taking his women with him. Pangborn had moved into the penthouse, once owned by the dead jeweler. Strangely enough, Royal reflected, they would soon be back where they had begun, each tenant isolated within his own apartment. Something warned him to dispense with this meal, but he waited for Mrs. Wilder to serve him. Having survived so far, nothing that the gynecologist could do would put him off his stride. During the past months, almost all traces of his accident had vanished, and Royal felt stronger and more confident than ever before. He had won his attempt to dominate the high-rise, and amply proved his right to rule this huge building, even though at the cost of his marriage. As for the new social order that he had hoped to see emerge, he knew now that his original vision of a high-rise aviary had been closer to the truth than he guessed. Without knowing it, he had constructed a gigantic vertical zoo, its hundreds of cages stacked above each other. All the events of the past few months made sense if one realized that these brilliant and exotic creatures had learned to open the doors. Royal sat back as Mrs. Wilder served him. Since his own kitchen lacked any equipment, all his meals were prepared in the apartment next door. Mrs. Wilder reappeared with her tray, stepping over the garbage sacks that lined the hallway. For all their descent into barbarism, the residents of the high-rise remained faithful to their origins and continued to generate a vast amount of refuse. As usual, the main course consisted of a piece of roast meat. Royal never asked about the source of the meat, dog, presumably. The women had the supply situation well in hand. Mrs. Wilder stood beside him, gazing into the night air as Royal tasted the heavily spiced dish. Like a well-trained housekeeper, she was waiting for Royal to give some indication of approval, though she never seemed concerned by either praise or criticism. She spoke in a flat voice, unlike the animated tone she used with Anne and the other women. In fact, Mrs. Wilder spent more time with his wife than Royal did himself. Six women lived together in the adjacent apartment, ostensibly so that they could be more easily protected from a surprise attack. Sometimes Royal would visit Anne, but there was something daunting about the closely knit group of women, sitting on their beds surrounded by the garbage sacks, together looking after the Wilder children. Their eyes would watch him as he hesitated in the door, waiting for him to go away. Even Anne had withdrawn from him, partly out of fear of Royal, but also because she realized that he no longer needed her. At last, after all the months of trying to maintain her superior status, Anne had decided to join her fellow residents.
"Good. It's excellent again. Wait, before you go."
Royal put down his fork. Casually, he asked,
"Have you heard anything of him? Perhaps someone has seen him."
Mrs. Wilder shook her head, bored by this roundabout questioning.
"Who?"
"Your husband.
Richard, I think he was called. Wilder."
Mrs. Wilder stared down at Royal, shaking her head as if not recognizing him. Royal was certain that she had not only forgotten the identity of her husband, but of all men, including himself. To test this, he placed his hand on her thigh, feeling the strong muscle. Mrs. Wilder stood passively with her tray, unaware of Royal fondling her, partly because she had been molested by so many men during the past months, but also because the sexual assault itself had ceased to have any meaning. When Royal slipped two of his fingers into her natal cleft, she reacted, not by pushing his hand away, but by moving it to her waist and lightly holding it there as she would the straying hands of her children. When she had gone, taking the portion of meat which Royal always left for her, he sat back at the long table. He was glad to see her go. Without asking him, Mrs. Wilder had laundered his white jacket, washing out the bloodstains which had given him not merely his sense of authority, but his whole unstated role within the high-rise. Had she done this deliberately, knowing that it would emasculate him? Royal could still remember the period of endless parties, when the apartment building had been lit up like a drunken liner. Royal had played the role of feudal chief to the hilt, presiding each evening over the council meetings held in his drawing room. As they sat together in the candlelight, these neurosurgeons, senior academics and stockbrokers, displayed all the talents for intrigue and survival, exercised by years of service in industry, commerce, and university life. For all the formal vocabulary of agendas and minutes, proposed and seconded motions, the verbal paraphernalia bequeathed by 100 committee meetings, these were in effect tribal conferences. Here they discussed the latest ruses for obtaining food and women, for defending the upper floors against marauders, their plans for alliance and betrayal. Now the new order had emerged, in which all life within the high-rise revolved around three obsessions: security, food, and sex. Leaving the table, Royal picked up a silver candlestick and carried it to the window. All the lights in the high-rise were out. Two floors, the 40th and the 37th, were left with electric current, but they remained unlit. The darkness was more comforting, a place where real illusions might flourish. 40 floors below, a car turned into the parking lot and threaded its way through the maze of access lanes to its place 200 yards from the building. The driver, wearing a flying jacket and heavy boots, stepped out and hurried head down towards the entrance. Royal guessed that this unknown man was probably the last resident to leave the building and set off for his office. Whoever he was, he had found a route to and from his apartment. Somewhere on the roof, a dog whimpered. Far below, from the mouth of an apartment 20 stories down the cliff face, there was a brief, isolated scream. Whether of pain, lust, or rage no longer mattered. Royal waited, his heart starting to race. A moment later there was a second scream, a meaningless wail. These cries were the expressions of totally abstracted emotions, detached from the context of events around them. Royal waited, expecting one of his retinue to enter and inform him of the probable reasons for these disturbances. Apart from the women in the next apartment, several of the younger male residents, a gallery owner from the 39th floor and a successful hairdresser from the 38th, usually lounged about in the corridor among the garbage sacks, leaning on their spears and keeping an eye on the staircase barricades. Picking up his chromium cane, Royal left the dining room, a single candle in its silver stick lighting his way. As he stumbled over the black plastic bags, he wondered why they had never heaved them over the side. Presumably they held this rubbish to themselves, less from fear of attracting the attention of the outside world than from a need to cling to their own. Surround themselves with a mucilage of unfinished meals, bloody bandage scraps, broken bottles that once held the wine that made them drunk, all faintly visible through the semi-opaque plastic. His apartment was empty, the high-ceilinged rooms deserted. Cautiously, Royal stepped into the corridor. The guard post by the barricades was unmanned, and no lights gleamed through the doorway of the adjacent apartment where the women lived. Surprised by the absence of light from the usually busy kitchen, Royal walked through the darkened hallway. He kicked aside a child's toy and raised the candlestick above his head, trying to pick out any sleeping human figures in the surrounding rooms. Open suitcases lay on the mattresses that covered the floor of the master bedroom. Royal stood in the doorway, a medley of scents crowding around him in the darkness. brilliant wakes left behind them by these fleeing women. Hesitating for a moment, he reached into the room and switched on the light. The instant electric glow, so unfamiliar after the wavering candlelight and twitching torch beams, shone down on the 6 mattresses in the room. Half-packed suitcases lay on top of each other, as if the women had left at a moment's notice, or at some prearranged signal. Most of their clothes had been left behind, and he recognized the trouser suit which Mrs. Wilder had worn to serve his dinner. The racks of Anne's dresses and suits hung in the wardrobes like a store display. The even light, as dead as a time exposure in a police photograph recording a crime, lay across these torn mattresses and discarded clothes, the wine stains on the walls and the forgotten cosmetics on the floor at his feet. As Royal stared down at them, he could hear a faint hooting noise from the darkened corridor, moving away from him as if emitted by these escaping women. This series of whoops and nasal grunts he had been listening to for days, trying without success to repress them from his mind. Switching off the light, he seized his cane firmly in both hands and left the apartment. Standing outside the door, he listened to the distant sounds, almost an electronic parody of a child's crying. They moved through the apartments at the far end of the floor, metallic and remote, the sounds of the beasts of his private zoo. Chapter 15. The Evening's Entertainment. The evening deepened, and the apartment building withdrew into the darkness. As usual at this hour, the high-rise was silent, as if everyone in the huge building was passing through a border zone. On the roof, the dogs whimpered to themselves. Royal blew out the candles in the dining room and made his way up the steps to the penthouse. Reflecting the distant lights of the neighboring high-rises, the chromium shafts of the calisthenics machine seemed to move up and down like columns of mercury, a complex device recording the shifting psychological levels of the residents below. As Royal stepped onto the roof, the darkness was lit by the white forms of hundreds of birds. Their wings flared in the dark air as they struggled to find a perch on the crowded elevator heads and balustrades. Royal waited until they surrounded him, steering their beaks away from his legs with his stick. He felt himself becoming calm again. If the women and the other members of his dwindling entourage had decided to leave him, so much the better. Here in the darkness among the birds, listening to them swoop and cry, the dogs whimpering in the children's sculpture garden, he felt most at home. He was convinced more than ever that the birds were attracted here by his own presence. Royal scattered the birds out of his way and pushed back the gates of the sculpture garden. As they recognized him, the dogs began to whine and strain, pulling against their leads. These retrievers, poodles, and dachshunds were all that remained of the 100 or so animals who had once lived in the upper floors of the high-rise. They were kept here as a strategic food reserve, but Royal had seen to it that few of them had been eaten. The dogs formed his personal hunting pack, to be kept until the final confrontation, when he would lead them down into the building and throw open the windows of the barricaded apartments to admit the birds. The dogs pulled at his legs, their leads entangled around the play sculptures. Even Royal's favorite, the white Alsatian, was restless and on edge. Royal tried to settle it, running his hands over the luminous but still blood-stained coat. The dog butted him nervously, knocking him back across the empty food pails. As Royal regained his balance, he heard the sound of voices surging up the central stairway 100 feet behind him. Lights approached through the darkness, a procession of electric torches held at shoulder height. The beams of light cut through the night air, scattering the birds into the sky. A portable cassette player boomed out its music over the clicking of dumbbells. As Royal paused behind an elevator head, a group of his top-floor neighbors erupted onto the roof. Led by Pangborn, they spread in a loose circle across the observation deck, ready to celebrate a recent triumph. Without Royal's approval or foreknowledge, a raid had taken place on the floors below. The gynecologist was in high excitement, waving the last stragglers up the staircase like a demented courier. From his mouth came a series of peculiar whoops and cries, barely articulated grunts, that sounded like some Neanderthal mating call. But in fact, were Pangborn's rendering of the recorded birth cries analyzed by his computer. These eerie and unsettling noises Royal had been forced to listen to for weeks, as members of his entourage took up the refrain. A few days earlier, he had finally banned the making of these noises altogether. Sitting in the penthouse and trying to think about the birds, it unnerved him to hear the women in the kitchen next door emitting these clicks and grunts. However, Pangborn held regular sessions in his own quarters at the opposite end of the roof, where he would play through his library of recorded birth cries for the benefit of the women crouching in a hushed circle on the floor around him. Together they mimicked these weird noises, an oral emblem of Pangborn's growing authority. Now they had left Royal and were giving full vent to everything they had learned, hooting and growling like a troop of demented mothers-to-be invoking their infants' birth traumas. Waiting for the right moment to make his entrance, Royal heeled the Alsatian behind a tattered awning that leaned against the elevator head. For once, he was glad that he was wearing his tuxedo. The white safari jacket would have stood out like a flame. Two guests had been picked up. A cost accountant from the 32nd floor with a bandaged head, and a myopic meteorologist from the 27th. The woman carrying the cassette player, he noted calmly, was his wife, Anne. Sloppily dressed, her hair in a mess, she lolled against Pangborn's shoulder and then wandered about in the circle of torchlight like a moody trollop, brandishing the cassette player at the two prisoners. "Ladies, please, now there's more to come." Pangborn calmed the women, his slim fingers like brittle sticks in the confused light. The portable bar was lifted upright. A table and two chairs were set beside it, and the guests uneasily took their seats. The cost accountant was trying to straighten the unraveling bandage around his head, as if frightened that he might be called upon to play blind man's buff. The meteorologist squinted short-sightedly into the torchlight, hoping to recognize someone among those taking part in this revel. Royal knew everyone present, his neighbors of the past year, and could almost believe that he was attending one of the many cocktail parties held on the roof that summer. At the same time, he felt that he was watching the opening act of a stylized opera or ballet, in which a restaurant is reduced to a single table, and the doomed hero is taunted by a chorus of waiters before being dispatched to his death. The hosts at this party had been drinking long before their two guests arrived. The jeweler's widow in the long fur coat, Anne with her cassette player, Jane Sheridan waving a cocktail shaker, all were lurching about, as if to some deranged music only Royal was unable to hear. Pangborn called for quiet again.
"Now keep our guests amused. They're looking bored. What are we playing tonight?"
A medley of suggestions was shouted out.
"Gangplank! Flying School, Doctor! Moonwalk!"
Pangborn turned to his guests.
"I rather like Flying School. Did you know we've been running a flying school here?"
"No."
"We've decided to offer you some free lessons," Anne Royal told them.
"One free lesson," Pangborn corrected.
Everyone sniggered at this.
"But that's all you'll need, isn't it, Anne?"
"It's a remarkably effective course."
"Solo first time, in fact."
Already, led by the jeweler's widow, they were dragging the injured accountant towards the balustrade, everyone tripping over the blood-stained bandage unwrapping around his head. A pair of tattered papier-mâché wings, part of a child's angel costume, were fastened to the victim's back. The grunting and hooting began again. Dragging the reluctant Alsatian after him, Royal stepped into view. Involved in their imminent execution, No one noticed him. As casually as he could muster, he called out,
"Pangborn! Dr. Pangborn!"
The noise slackened. Torch beams flicked through the darkness, whipping across Royal's silk-lapelled dinner jacket, fixing on the white Alsatian trying to escape between his feet.
"Flying school! Flying school!"
The sullen chant was taken up. Looking down at this unruly gang, Royal could almost believe that he was surrounded by a crowd of semi-literate children. The zoo had rebelled against its keeper. Hearing Royal's voice, the gynecologist turned from his prisoner, whose bandage he had expertly refastened. Wiping his hands, he strolled across the roof, almost mimicking Royal's casual saunter. But his eyes were examining Royal's face with a wholly professional curiosity, as if he had already decided that its expression of firm determination could be readjusted by cutting a minimum number of nerves and muscles. The chant rose into the air. The torch beams beat rhythmically across the darkness, striking Royal's face. He waited patiently for the clamor to subside. As Anne broke away from the crowd and ran forward, he raised his chromium cane, ready to strike her. She stopped in front of him, smirking as she fluffed up her long skirt in a provocative gesture. Suddenly she turned the cassette player to full volume and thrust it into his face. A gabble of birth cries filled the air.
"Royal!"
the jeweler's widow shouted warningly.
"He is Wilder!"
Startled by the name, Royal flinched back, thrashing at the darkness with the chromium cane. The torch beams swerved around him, the shadows of the overturned chairs swinging across the concrete roof. Expecting Wilder to lunge at him from behind, he stumbled across the awning and entangled himself in the dog's lead. He heard laughter behind him. Controlling himself with an effort, he turned to face Pangborn again. But the gynecologist was walking away, looking back at him without hostility. He waved to Royal with a quick movement of his hand, as if flicking a dart at him, dismissing him forever. The torches swung away from Royal, and everyone returned to the more serious business of tormenting the two guests. Royal watched from the darkness as they argued over the prisoners. The confrontation with Pangborn was over, or more exactly, had never taken place. A simple ruse had unnerved him, leaving him with the uncertainty of whether or not he really feared Wilder. He had been humiliated, but in a sense, this was only just. The gynecologist was the man for their hour. No zoo would survive for long with Pangborn as its keeper, but he would provide a node of violence and cruelty that would keep alive in others the will to survive. Let the psychotics take over. They alone understood what was happening. Holding to the Alsatian, Royal let the dog drag him away towards the safety of the darkness near the sculpture garden. The white forms of the birds were massed together on every ledge and parapet. Royal listened to the whimpering dogs. He had no means now of feeding them. The glass doors of the penthouse reflected the swerving birds, like the casements of a secret pavilion. He would close down his apartment, block the staircase, and retreat to the penthouse, perhaps taking Mrs. Wilder with him as his servant. Here he would preside over the high-rise, taking up his last tenancy in the sky. He unlocked the gate of the sculpture garden and moved through the darkness among the statues, releasing the dogs. One by one they scrambled away, until only Royal and the birds were left. Chapter 16. A Happy Arrangement. An uncertain scene, Robert Lang decided. He could no longer trust his senses. A curious light, grey and humid but at the same time marbled by a faint interior luminosity, hung over the apartment. As he stood among the garbage sacks in the kitchen, trying to coax a few drops of water from the tap, he peered over his shoulder at the dull fog that stretched like a curtain across the sitting room, almost an extension of his own mind. Not for the first time, he was unsure what time of day it was. How long had he been up? Lang vaguely remembered sleeping on the tartan rug that lay on the kitchen floor, his head pillowed on a garbage sack between the table legs. He had been wandering about the bedroom where his sister Alice lay asleep, but whether he had woken 5 minutes ago or the previous day, Lang had no means of telling. He shook his watch, picking at the fractured dial with a grimy fingernail. The watch had stopped during a scuffle in the 25th floor lobby several days earlier. Although he had forgotten the exact moment, the hands of this broken watch contained the one point of finite time left to him, like a fossil cast onto a beach, crystallizing forever a brief sequence of events within a vanished ocean. However, it barely mattered now what time it was, anything rather than night, when it was too terrifying to do more than shelter in the apartment, crouching behind his dilapidated barricade. Lang turned the cold water tap on and off, listening to the faintly changing tone. At rare intervals, perhaps for a single minute during the day, a green, algae-stained liquid flowed from the tap. These small columns of water, moving up and down the huge system of pipes that ran throughout the building, announced their arrivals and departures with faint changes of note. Listening to this remote and complex music had sharpened Lang's ears, a sensitivity that extended to almost any kind of sound within the building. By contrast, his sight, dulled by being used chiefly at night, presented him with an increasingly opaque world. Little movement took place within the high-rise. As Lang often reminded himself, almost everything that could happen had already taken place. He left the kitchen and squeezed himself into the narrow niche between the front door and the barricade. He placed his right ear to the sounding panel of the wooden door. From the minute reverberations, he could tell instantly if a marauder was moving through the abandoned apartments nearby. During the brief period each afternoon when he and Steele emerged from their apartments, a token remembrance of that time when people had actually left the building, they would take turns standing with their hands pressed against the metal walls of an elevator shaft, feeling the vibrations transmitted to their bodies, picking up a sudden movement 15 floors above or below. Crouched on the staircase, with their fingers on the metal rails, they listened to the secret murmurs of the building, the distant spasms of violence that communicated themselves like bursts of radiation from another universe. The high-rise quivered with these tremors, sinister trickles of sound as a wounded tenant crawled up a stairway, a trap closed around a wild dog, an unwary prey went down before a club. Today, however, befitting this timeless zone with its uncertain light, there was no sound at all. Lang returned to the kitchen and listened to the water pipes, part of a huge acoustic system operated by thousands of stops, this dying musical instrument they had once all played together. But everything was quiet. The residents of the high-rise remained where they were, hiding behind the barricades in their apartments, conserving what was left of their sanity and preparing themselves for the night. By now, what violence there was had become totally stylized, spasms of cold and random aggression. In a sense, life in the high-rise had begun to resemble the world outside. There were the same ruthlessness and aggression, concealed within a set of polite conventions. Still uncertain how long he had been awake, or what he had been doing half an hour earlier, Lang sat down among the empty bottles and refuse on the kitchen floor. He gazed up at the derelict washing machine and refrigerator, now only used as garbage bins. He found it hard to remember what their original function had been. To some extent, they had taken on a new significance, a role that he had yet to understand. Even the run-down nature of the high-rise was a model of the world into which the future was carrying them, a landscape beyond technology, where everything was either derelict or more ambiguously recombined in unexpected but more meaningful ways. Lang pondered this. Sometimes he found it difficult not to believe that they were living in a future that had already taken place and was now exhausted. Squatting beside his dried-up waterhole, like a desert nomad with all the time in the world, Lang waited patiently for the taps to flow. He picked at the dirt on the backs of his hands. Despite his tramp-like appearance, he dismissed the notion of using the water to wash. The high-rise stank. None of the lavatories or garbage disposal chutes were working, and a faint spray of urine hung over the face of the building, drifting across the tiers of balconies. Overlaying this characteristic odor, however, was a far more ambiguous smell, putrid and sweet, that tended to hover around empty apartments and which Lang chose not to investigate too closely. For all its inconveniences, Lang was satisfied with life in the high-rise. Now that so many of the residents were out of the way, he felt able to relax, more in charge of himself, and ready to move forward and explore his life. How and where exactly, he had not yet decided. His real concern was with his sister. Alice had fallen ill with a non-specific malaise, and spent her time lying on the mattress in Lang's bedroom, or wandering half-naked around the apartment, her body shuddering like an oversensitive seismograph at imperceptible tremors that shook the building. When Lang drummed on the waste pipe below the sink, sending a hollow drone through the empty pipe, Alice called out from the bedroom in her thin voice. Lang went in to see her, picking his way among the piles of kindling he had made from chopped-up furniture. He enjoyed cutting up the chairs and tables. Alice pointed to him with a stick-like hand. "The noise. You're signalling again to someone. Who is it now?" "No one, Alice. Who do you think we know?"
"Those people on the lower floors. The ones you like."
Lang stood beside her, uncertain whether to sit on the mattress. His sister's face was as greasy as a wax lemon. Trying to focus on him, her tired eyes drifted about in her head, like lost fish. It crossed his mind briefly that she might be dying. During the past 2 days they had eaten no more than a few fillets of canned smoked salmon, which he had found under the floorboards in an empty apartment. Ironically, the standard of cuisine in the apartment building had begun to rise during these days of its greatest decline, as more and more delicacies came to light. However, food was a secondary matter, and Alice was very much alive in other ways. Lang enjoyed her wheedling criticisms of him, as he tried to satisfy her pointless whims. All this was a game, but he relished the role of overdutiful servant dedicated to a waspish mistress, a devoted menial whose chief satisfaction was a total lack of appreciation and the endless recitation of his faults. In many ways, in fact, his relationship with Alice recapitulated that which his wife had unthinkingly tried to create, hitting by accident on the one possible source of harmony between them, and which Lang had rejected at the time. Within the high-rise, he reflected, his marriage would have succeeded triumphantly. "I'm trying to find some water, Alice. You'd like a little tea?"
"The kettle smells."
"I'll wash it for you. You mustn't become dehydrated." She nodded grudgingly.
"What's been happening?"
"Nothing. It's already happened." A
ripe but not unpleasant smell rose from Alice's body. "Everything is starting to get back to normal."
"What about Alan? You said you'd look for him."
"I'm afraid he's gone."
Lang disliked these references to Alice's husband. They introduced a discordant note.
"I found your apartment, but it's empty now."
Alice turned her head away, indicating that she had seen enough of her brother. Lang bent down and gathered together the kindling she had scattered on the floor beside the mattress. These dining room chair legs, well impregnated with glue and varnish, would burn briskly. Lang had looted the chairs from Adrian Talbot's apartment after the psychiatrist's disappearance. He was grateful for this reproduction Hepplewhite. The conventional tastes of the middle-floor residents had served them well. By contrast, those on the lower levels found themselves with a clutter of once fashionable chromium tubing and undressed leather, useless for anything but sitting on. All cooking was now done over fires which the residents lit for themselves on their balconies or in the artificial fireplaces. Lang carried the sticks onto the balcony. As he squatted there, he realized that he had nothing to cook. The secret cache of cans he had long ago been obliged to surrender to the orthodontic surgeon next door. In fact, Lang's position was secure, thanks only to the morphine ampoules he had concealed. Although steel frightened him with his unpredictable cruelties, Lang had attached himself to him out of necessity. So many people had gone, or dropped out of the struggle altogether. Had they deserted the high-rise for the world outside? Lang was sure that they had not. In a sense, he depended on the uncertainties of his relationship with the dentist, following his murderous swings like a condemned prisoner in love with a moody jailer. During the previous weeks, Steele's behavior had become frightening. The deliberately mindless assaults on anyone found alone or unprotected, the infantile smearing of blood on the walls of empty apartments, all these Lang watched uneasily. Since his wife's disappearance, Steele had been as tautly strung as the huge crossbows which he constructed from piano wire and mounted in the lobbies and corridors, their vicious arrows fashioned from the shafts of gold.